So, hello and welcome to this week's instalment of Nucleus Investment Insights. And we've entitled this one, The Return of the Beast, or as another name, The Future of Australian Property. We've got a really big show today, and I'm very excited to jump into it. So, I'll start by with a few introductions in no particular order. We've got our Head of Investments, Damien Klassen, with us today.
Hi, Tim.
We've got our Chief Strategist, David Llewellyn-Smith. G'day, David.
Hi, Tim.
We've got our Chief Economist, Leith Van Onselen.
Hi, Leith.
Hello.
And a very special guest has joined us today. It's Melbourne, maybe Australia's favourite buyer's advocate for property, Catherine Cashmore. Welcome, Catherine.
Hi, Tim. Hi.
Excellent, excellent. So, look, what we'll do, we've got a slightly different format today because we have got a big panel. So, we've just got the one slide, which I'll be putting up in the podcast, running through a series of house price factors with a bit of reflection on the last 5 odd years versus looking forward, well, now and then looking forward. So I'll hand over to Damien. He's the chief operator of or constructor of putting this one together. You might be able to just walk us through it and then we can get going.
Yeah, sure. So look, the idea is behind this is what I wanted to do is just expand on what's driven the house price boom over the last sort of, or from 2012 to 17. Then look at sort of what went wrong in 2018 and what really dragged prices back. And they're now sort of post-election going through each of those factors and having a closer look. So for people just listening in on the podcast, our first three are probably the biggest. So we're actually going to skip over those to start with just because we think they're going to take the longest to run through, which is the availability of credit, the price of credit, so basically interest rates, and then employment. And then there's a whole bunch of other factors we think have gone into to house prices, and some of the guys might pop up with a few more as we go through, but these are things like population growth, foreign buyers, tax incentives, money laundering laws, and then some of the supply factors, sort of slow land release and restrictive planning, and then an under-oversupply. In particular, to do with the apartment boom that we've had, which has got sort of much longer lags than ordinary houses. So with all that sort of, in front of us, I might sort of kick in with, my take on the population growth and is that we've seen, certainly that 2012 to 2017, we saw much stronger levels than what we'd seen in prior periods. Leith's probably the king of population growth, so we might throw toss across to him. But it was pretty similar for 2018, I guess possibly a little bit slower. But post-election, there have been some noises made towards pulling back population growth. But whether that's true or whether that's just more in the statistics, I guess we'll toss across to you.
No, actually, population growth's rising again. Immigration's started to rise again last year, 2018, which is the latest figures we've got. And the monthly net long-term arrivals data, which comes from the ABS, is also showing a big pickup that's kicked up to about 300,000, which obviously is a main driver of population growth. So if anything, population growth's accelerating. And we've just had a record intakes of international students, which is obviously one of the main drivers, as well as a big rise in bridging visas. So basically the coalition government has cut the permanent migrant intake by about 20,000. However, that's been more than replaced by surging international students and also a big rise in bridging visas, which are basically handed out to people who are awaiting permanent residency, and those have gone up to 75,000 in the last 2 years. So population growth is a positive factor.
Hmm, interesting. Okay. Any takes on that, David?
I just would like to add something on international students. Yes, we saw a big surge in the first quarter, which, you know, is not unexpected given enrolments, etc. But it's pretty clear that the Chinese intake is getting hit for any number of reasons, either constraints coming from the Chinese authorities themselves, who may be subtly punishing us for Huawei or other trade war issues, it may just be a natural market phenomenon where, you know, we're competing with others and that trade is just starting to tail off. But the upshot is that The Chinese were a dominant component of that student intake, and so it's going to get harder to sustain the big boom we saw in the first quarter, because it looks like those Chinese students are going to plateau, or the growth is, at least, and there is some risk of them falling, given the, you know, sort of exploding trade war context, which, you know, China has to confront on, both politically, where it could pull levers to punish other countries, but also just to control its currency, given it, you know, its domestic growth is going to slow, it'll have to cut interest rates, its yuan will be under pressure. So it may restrict capital outflows in the form of things like international students and or tourists.
And the other thing on population growth is it does tend to be quite linked to economic growth in the country. So yeah, people who are looking to move, I think Catherine was just talking about an Uber driver who had moved here for economic reasons. When, you know, if you do get downturns and unemployment starts to rise, then you do find fewer people, you know, from, so there is a cyclical element, I suppose, in terms of you know, the employment outlook. To me, is quite important to if we do get a downturn in employment, we could see that.
Yes, there are strong market elements to population and students. Yes,
yeah. Quick one. Yeah. Go on. No, I was going to say just a quick one for Catherine. Get that bike organised. Yeah, so obviously coming, and I'm going to probably refer to you a few times for coalface questions, but in your experience, have you seen any sort of change somewhat, perhaps in looking back over the last 5 years to now? Is there sort of, as a canary in the coal mine from, you know, your experience in the property market?
Yeah, I mean, I can only talk from my own experience, which we have certainly seen an influx of immigration buying into the housing market from China and from India. In fact, the Indian population that are buying houses are in my experience, is increasing.
Wow.
From the clients and the inquiry that I get.
Can I ask, do they sort of go after the same type of property, or does it, like, the Chinese, to some extent at least, were in the established housing market as opposed to apartment market?
Yeah.
Whereas the Indians seem a little more oriented towards new builds. Is that right or not?
Yeah, initially what you would find is that the population would come in, they'd want to buy a home, and the only areas that they could afford would be down in the outer suburbs, so places in Melbourne like Point Cook and Mernda and areas like that, where they could go and buy a new house for their family. Then they would get very savvy about how real estate works. They would do their own research and investigation, and then that's where they would slip over to the same things that we saw with the Chinese, and that is buying in family packs and buying house on land and extremely quickly as well. So I mean, I know some migrants that have been over here, say, for 10 years and have already stacked up 13 houses that have got into the market and really are pouring all their money that way.
Yeah, fascinating. Okay.
Yeah, that sort of segues into our next one, which is the foreign buyer market, which, so that 2012 to 2017 period, we saw a big influx of foreign buyers over that, I guess, relative to prior years, which really helped push the prices up. 2018 appears to have seen a step back in that market, in particular some of the Chinese buyers. And so then the question sort of going forward is, you know, I've marked it as a negative, not a big negative, but as a negative, just expecting that'll tail off. But again, that's a relatively unknown part. David's probably jumped in and already on some of the Chinese, you know.
Yeah, I guess
that
I
might
just
get taken up by other areas.
The pressure from the Chinese side, I think, will just be sustained again on because of their currency. So there'll be more capital controls. It'll just remain difficult for them to get their money out of China. It may not get more difficult, but it certainly won't get easier.
Okay.
So, I mean, relative to that 2012-2017 period, it will be a negative.
Okay. And back to you, Catherine. Foreign buyers, in your experience, have you...
In your expectation, I guess.
Expectation, rather, yeah, looking forward.
Positive for the market, a negative for the market, neutral?
If we see the market start to rise, then people see opportunity in that. Because obviously the reason for buying into the Australian market primarily is the speculative aspect of the unearned income that you can get from land. And if you start to see that ramp up again, then people will find a way to invest in the market and buy. Remember, we've got quite a few things that have come in for overseas buyers, in particular foreign buyers, where, you know, higher stamp duties, higher land taxation, those are a natural deterrent,
mm.
but they're not complete deterrent. I mean, obviously, access to money is a big thing, which is why the real estate market slowed over 2018, you know, the end of 2017, 2018, and coming into 2019.
That the banks would probably have to loosen constraints on that front as well. They also tightened a lot around prospective foreign buyers at the instruction of APRA. So, I mean, we don't have a lot of faith in APRA to sustain any kind of break on anything, but at this point at least that foreign buyer constraint is still there in the banks as well.
100%. I don't expect it to affect our market significantly.
Mm. Mm. Okay. Yeah.
Tax incentives. So, look, I've doubled up on the positive for tax incentives for that 2012 to 2017 as well, just to say that's and a lot of that's sort of flowing through, I guess, from some of the changes that were made pre-financial crisis in terms of the cutting your capital gains tax and things like that. That sort of and we've got this continued negative gearing, obviously, but things that when the market goes up a lot, they get added to that whole benefit of, you know, I guess people seeing that they're rolling out of this money and not paying as much capital gains tax and seeing the effects and then saying, well, let me do that again. You know, that worked well once. Let me, as you said, let me buy another property, another one and another one. And so then the tax incentive sort of, I think for 2018, I've said it's neutral, possibly a little bit negative in terms of there was a very big expectation that Labor would win and you get these negative gearing changes. And so, you know, I think it's certainly in terms of the outlook for people, it was maybe a negative, at least neutral. In the industry, certainly there's been this big lift recently of, hey, we've got these things back and you know, Scott Morrison used to be the property council on the property council and he's got our back and he's chasing, you know, he's already changing the rules for first home buyers and there's probably more to come if the housing market starts to go down. So I'm saying that's a big positive, a double positive on the way up. Catherine, is your
Every real estate agent has got a big smile on his her face following the general election for sure. I mean, that was I had clients that were holding off in wait for the election. We knew on the ground that it was a deterrent coming up because, you know, the only reason the real estate prices are so high is because of the tax system. The tax system dictates how you invest, and you know that you can earn a lot more through owning a good piece of land than you can through most of your income earning. I had clients that were waiting off for the election, but also the Royal Commission. We knew that was going to finish in February as well. So in terms of, you know, waiting for that investment to come back into the market, about 4 weeks before the election, a couple of things happened were becoming really evident. One was that stock tightened. So it was evident on the ground quite markedly. I looked at the CoreLogic stats, and it was marginal, very marginal on the CoreLogic that came through. But that really indicated that the carnage had cleared through 2018. And what I mean by the carnage is that vendors who had to sell had sold. The ones that were thinking prices were going to continue dropping, so they better bring forward their plans to sell, had cleared. The stock had cleared because the vendors had finally met the market, which of course was a lot lower. I mean, if you were a buyer that was able to borrow 900,000, say in 2017, that went down in some cases to sort of 500,000. And then the other thing that started to happen, which was inevitable, is the rise in rents.
Mm.
And the property manager started to say, we've got to really, you know, we have 100%. We don't have any more vacancies available, and the rental market became very tight. And of course, that was because construction has slowed significantly. It's killed the development industry. Developers have not been able to borrow through private finance. The interest rates are still quite high. So we did get a lot of stock coming on the market with plans and permits of people that hadn't been able to get finance. The properties that were going to be constructed now were not constructed. So it's a shortage of available properties on the market. Plus, you know, I always say this as you know, I'm president of Prosper Australia. I always say this to the guys at Prosper. We advocate, obviously, for a change in the tax system to make land more affordable. But really, in reality, in the market that we've got now, nobody wants affordable housing because nobody wants to buy into a market where the prices are going backwards. Mm. And so you have people that were thinking about buying stay in the rental market, and because rent started to rise. Now, that happened before the election. All we needed on the ground to see that prices are going to start rising was one, the Labour not to get in, and two was the banking to show evidence that they were starting to loosen the, you know, the lending standards.
I'll just add one more on. I guess this goes under tax, but the first home buyer guarantee that's going to come in early next year. I mean, it's still very vague, but it potentially looks quite big in terms of demand pull forward. If you only have to save 5% deposit versus 20%, I mean, that's obviously a positive, which is one of the reasons we've got two green arrows for positives post-election. How do you see that playing out, Catherine?
Well, same as any first home buyer's grant. I mean, you know, you can have a look at what's going on now and say, well, it's a bit of a panic move. You know, you only need prices to drop a little bit further and then you're going to have more people that are underwater. Mm. And once those people need to sell, then you're potentially looking at a financial crisis. Now, anybody who's in policy or in banking understands that, right? So they realise that they have to put incentives back into the market. That's exactly what happened in 2008. That was a panic move too, but it had the effect that it needed to have. I mean, the only difference with this is how long is that guarantee going to be available for?
It's capped at 10,000, no. but he said it'll expand it to whatever is needed, basically. Mm-hmm. So as long as it's needed, I suspect is the answer. We should move on.
We'll take anyone who'll throw extra money at the problem.
And also the stamp duty incentives that are still there. You know, that was one actually area of the market that was holding up over this period of time, was first home buyers moving in because they don't have to pay stamp duty under 600,000. The prices have gone down. It's investors have gone elsewhere. So it's an opportunity for them to get in. And
get in where?
Get into the market.
For 600K.
You would be amazed. The price drops. Look, you don't see it when you're just looking at the charts, but the price drops have been significant, and I can give you many stories as examples of that. I mean, we're looking from...
Much larger than the indexes.
Much larger than the indexes on it. It depends whether you're dealing... Look, when you get a downturn, it's not like, you know, vendors say, oh, well, look, the market's dropped 10%, I better drop my price 10%. It's about taking those opportunities that are available from the vendors that have to sell. And those ones that found themselves in the market where they had to sell because they'd already bought elsewhere and they were about to go on to bridging finance, the negotiation conditions became very, very advantageous. And I know with my clients, we secure properties from vendors that were so angry they knocked the for sale sign down on the properties. I mean, it was a great market to buy into. So it's not necessarily that you think to yourself, well, I'm getting something 10%. Because the prices have dropped, median prices have dropped 10%. You know, in some situations, it was significantly more than that. So there are opportunities out there.
Can you give us a feel on which segments were hit hardest?
You always say when you see a downturn in the real estate market, it's the volatile sector of the market that's going to be hit the most, so the high price market. But I had a buyer that was over 3 million. And we missed out on 5 auctions where it absolutely flew over the reserve. And I said to him, look, we've got to go down. We've got to put down an offer prior to auction, which normally in this market you never do because your perfect scenario is that it passes in and you do a negotiation, which we did. We didn't get that one either. But the only reason I can give for that is because this was hitting the mortgage market. It was a mortgage crisis. You couldn't borrow. And if you were outside of that crisis, you had the capital and you had, you know, that.
So the mortgage belts?
The mortgage belts, yeah.
Okay.
Fascinating. Yes, Lee.
That's interesting because the CoreLogic data says that in Sydney and Melbourne at least, it was the top 25% that's been smashed by far the hardest, whereas the bottom 25% has held up really well. So what I reckon that is, it's probably the top 5% within that 25%'s held up really well because a lot of them are obviously ultra wealthy, maybe paying with cash, they don't need mortgages, whereas the bottom 20% of that 25% has been smashed.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. I mean, again, it really depends on the vendor's reason to sell, but the properties that you're really looking at are the really high quality properties where people are buying for the fact that it's a location. You know, in Melbourne, it would be a, you know, really good property in a certain pocket of Armadale, where there's very few listings come up,
and the
market was still very strong in that sector.
I've just had a question come in, just to sort of break it up before we head into money laundering. If there was a significant downturn in the economy, would there be an expectation that a large number of immigrants would leave Australia to chase financial gains elsewhere? And I guess thinking Ireland would be probably a prime example of that. Yep.
Yeah.
Who'd like to take that one?
Well, I might start with this one because that was sort of leading into one of the questions I had for Catherine, which is this it sounds as if we're starting to talk about a few pro-cyclical things here in terms of saying if we get employment holds up, if we get the prices start to tick up, then we could easily see, you know, that adds more as we get all this, you know, that means employment keeps holding up and more foreign buyers come in and more investors say, okay, well, that's it. We've seen the bottom. Let's all pile in. Whereas if we go the other way and you get a tick down and unemployment ticks down and then you might see people flee. And so it almost seems as if it's a bit of a binary outcome where we're headed in one direction. We just don't know which.
Yeah, it's 100%. I mean, you can look at Perth.
Yeah.
I mean, who's hanging around in Perth at the moment? The economy's shot over there. So, and if you look historically too, I mean, you know that I adhere to the 18-year cycle in real estate, which I think is pretty firm at the moment. But, you know, you look at any downturn, which is a real estate crash, and most of all the significant downturns really are caused by a crash in land prices. Yeah. That's where the banks lend into. You see migration from one area into another, and even with money as well. You know, you see that flooding. Look at the money that flooded into London and New York in 2008, which actually held those markets up, you know, because people are looking for safe havens. Same in Germany.
Mm. Do you think it would be that flighty, though? Like, would we need a fairly significant sort of Irish-style property and financial crisis combined, do you think, in order to get that sort of flight of the margins?
Yeah, well, this is one area where Australia's full recourse mortgages could come home to bite. We saw in Ireland. Ireland's got the strictest bankruptcy laws in the world. You can actually go to prison if you, I'm not sure if they actually enforce it, but the rules are you can go to prison if you don't pay your debt. And we found that after the Irish real estate market busted, that a lot of people just left because they were left in negative equity. And so they fled the country. And that led to a massive outward migration, obviously precipitated a deeper crash. So, you know, I guess at the extreme, Australia's full recourse mortgages could actually work against it if the crash is big enough and if it then leads to outward migration and, you know, people abandoning their mortgages and et cetera. But that's obviously a pretty extreme outcome.
So. You do have to bear in mind, of course, that the Irish crash transpired in a global financial crisis as well.
Mm.
So, I mean, you've got to have really intense external pressures too, which we don't have right now, but it's... we do have a deteriorating external environment that could go that way, not as severe, most likely. But if the Cold War 2.0 continues to intensify the way it is at the moment, it is going to blow back into wider markets and you'll get some kind of equity market accident followed, you know, usually by some debt crunch somewhere. And that's a scenario in which you could get those more extreme outcomes. But without that kind of external pressure, I don't think you're going to get it internally alone.
Mm, okay. All right. Sure thing. Thanks for that. And thanks, Homer's Odyssey, for that question. Money laundering. Jumping down.
Yeah, I'll make that a quick one. So, Australia's been pushing... Australia put in some money laundering across a range of different sectors and specifically has excluded housing. And how many years are we up to now?
So basically early 2000, I think it was 2003, we agreed to implement money laundering laws across all sectors. And we're still waiting. 2019, still no money laundering for reforms for real estate gatekeepers. But that may change. The Financial Action Task Force, who's a global regulator, lambasted us in 2015 and basically embarrassed the hell out of Australia, saying that we're a haven for money laundering. And they're due to hold their next mutual evaluation of Australia in September. So that'll lead to more pressure, probably more promises from the government that they'll do something. And
No action.
Yeah, probably nothing.
That's zero.
But I'm forever the optimist. I don't know why. Yeah. I keep getting disappointed.
Yeah. I'll prepare you now, Leith. our Prime Minister, who's basically said, what does he say? Something about property prices will be higher under a coalition government than what it will a Labor government. He ain't putting in money laundering to clear out anytime soon.
And we will remain the South Pacific haven for money laundering.
Yeah,
absolutely. So I've got that as a positive, a big positive, 2012 to 2017, partly because, as Leith said, other countries have been all adding it. And so as you start going, well, I need to launder my money, well, I go to this country or that country or this one, and slowly your list of countries gets down and down and down, and but Australia's still there, and some nice big cities you can stick your money into. So, yeah, so I've got that still as a positive. That's been a positive all the way through. And Leith might have that as a neutral or a negative in that post-election. I've got it as a positive because I'm not expecting any changes.
Yeah, well, I mean, I guess it's neutral in that it's that there's no change. So it'd be no change from the status quo.
Well, yeah, but it's more relative. Yeah. I guess what I'm saying is if other countries are closing down, then Australia becomes relatively more attractive.
And just I'll just add something really quick. Transparency International did a benchmarking Australia against all the other Anglo countries, and we failed every single one of their 10-point checklists. We're the most open system for money laundering in a property. So go Australia, gold medal again.
Supply factors. So then, I mean, I guess this is sort of this slow land release and the restrictive planning. You know, Australia, as I like to say, you know, ex Antarctica, we're the least populated country on the planet. And so you would think, you know, broadly speaking, you'd have lower land prices, but we don't. A lot of that's urbanisation, but it's also this sort of slow land release and restrictive planning processes. I haven't seen any changes to that. I mean, there's a lot of talk about it, but I haven't seen any changes over that period. So I'm just saying that's a net positive over that whole time period, but nothing really on the border, Catherine. Anything?
Well, the government don't have the control over the release of land supply, do they? Mm. I mean, the developers go and buy it up on options, and they've got, what, 14 to 16 years was the studies that we've done at Prosper with the handful of big ones. And they're the ones that drip feed it onto the market in staged releases to maintain high prices, and that's not going to change.
Yeah. Is that a government response sort of thing, though? And obviously, you know, perhaps with a bit of a Prosper viewpoint as well. Like, is it the only way it's ever going to work? Otherwise, we're just going to have ring-fenced capital cities everywhere controlled by, you know, oligopoly developers.
There's two ways to change it. One is through the tax system to deter people from holding land through a significant land tax. I think when we did our research on Canberra, at one point they had on the developers, had a land tax, and it actually didn't bring stock onto the market all that much faster. The other thing is to do like Germany does, where the government actually buys the land from the farmers at just above agricultural prices, and then they sell it to the small home builders. They basically sell it onto the market themselves. So you're selling it at the land price, and then the buyers then go and employ a builder to come and do the house build. So the government does actually have the control over like how the land
reaches socialized MERVAC.
I think there's a whole podcast topic in this in itself. I think we might sorry to skip us on, but I think we could be forever on that.
It's not going to change.
It's not looking like changing. It's a message. But what that actually does mean as well. So this most of the growth was focused on apartments. There's a much longer lead time. So ideally, in a housing market, you've got this responsive supply where prices start to tick up, and then all of a sudden, all these houses come on, and you know that keeps prices from getting too far out of control. In Australia, we've had partly the opposite because of that, but the other part is because so much of it's been focused on apartments, they've got a much longer lead time to get the plans through and then to build and get the whole thing done. And so that just extends our whole, extends that spring so that we have a longer period of undersupply, and then all of a sudden all this supply starts to hit. And I guess that's where I'm thinking where we are at the moment is, as you said, Catherine, there's a lot of things not going ahead, but there's also a lot of projects that were started 2 and 3 years ago that are finishing up and may or may not have been sold, or they've been sold to people who can no longer afford the deposit and the price has gone down, and so they need to find a new buyer. And so I'm marking that as a positive for 2012 to 17, turning negative last year and negative again going forward. That would be interesting, your thoughts.
Yeah, I actually think that contrary to everything that I've written for the first half of the cycle, I actually think that you might actually see a very short-term push in apartment prices because of the supply has been hit so significantly. Plus, you will find that the...
You're talking Melbourne particularly.
I'm talking in Melbourne, yeah. I'm not talking Brisbane.
Because Sydney's a flash with apartments, isn't it?
It is, and so is Brisbane. And there's so many factors that go into it, but I'm just talking about what the supply that is available on the market. And if you look at the rental supply in any one place, I mean, I know this because I don't own where I live. I've always rented where I live, and I recently had to go back into the rental market to look for an apartment, and to get a really nice apartment, I took it sight unseen in the end, because the rental market was such a hot market in the areas that I was looking in. And so I think because of that, because the rents are rising and people are fighting for the rentals and people are actually bidding above the rent price of the reports that we're getting in, you might actually see that feed. Well, you've got to see it. Not you might. You have to see that feed into the prices, because obviously if you're going to get a higher return on the apartment that you buy, and then you're going to get a higher price for it. It doesn't mean that they're good investments. I've never advised anyone to buy an apartment. You can do a lot better with your money.
Yeah, in the Australian vernacular, you've just reduced your negative gearing, though. What are you doing?
Even if you're buying for yield, I think you can do better than
depreciation, you Catherine. Come on, depreciation.
Depreciation, but then have a look at the owner's court fee.
Flammable value. Yeah, that's right.
Depreciating to zero. Just a quick one on that supply one before we jump into the bigger topics of credit availability et al. Just for you, Catherine. So obviously we've got general idea of supply is you've either got out of fringe sort of house and land, and you've got apartments, as you mentioned. I'd be interested to know just the sort of internal, part of that spectrum, which is inner suburbs, perhaps in desirable areas, being cut up into blocks and like battle axes, I guess the old term. But do you see outside of the big developments and high rises in town, do you see that there is a rise in supply in those, or is there a drive for that? And I remember reading a bit there was in the last sort of few years. Is that, have you seen that take off? What do you think that's going to go going forward?
Well, most of my clients are developers.
Okay.
So I have a whole development arm of the business that runs for people that want to do developments and make a profit out of it. So I'm dealing with small developers all the time who aren't speculators, because development runs on what your end prices are in today's market. And you're looking at buying the land and securing a profit for the amount of money you go. What's killed that industry has been the Royal Commission, because developers have not been able to secure finance. And
so that's hit the urban infill thing as well.
It's hit the urban infill. And then the other issue that we have constant problems with, and again, it doesn't come through on the data, but it is absolutely evident on the ground, is that it can take three times longer to get council approval to do a simple side-by-side or three-unit development than it does to actually build the thing. And then, of course, when you're going for finance, if you the people that were building into the 2018 market, a lot of the time those properties were not selling for the price that they needed them to sell for. So then they were renting them, and then the banks would only take in, say, 65% of the rent into account, and so they couldn't refinance through bank lending. And it's really put a lot of developers out of business.
Have any of your developers seen any easing in that at all?
Not at all, no. The hardest thing that we find is getting finance, and to get private finance, we're still around that 10%. Interest rate, unless you really have a financial provider that you work with that obviously has you have a level of experience.
And do you think there's latent supply then? So that that's sitting there going, okay, if prices rise 5-10%, then all of a sudden we've got this flood of supply from developers and possibly people who are upgraders or downgraders who have been sitting there going, well, I don't want to make a loss on this, so I'll just hold off until...
Any latent supply would have been outweighed by the fact by the developers that could not secure finance and then couldn't go on to complete the project. Right. And it goes further than that. So say you're hunting around for a block of land with an old house on that you want to go and live in, and that vendor has gone and got plans and permits for a development. You cannot get residential finance for that property. I say that as a kind of broad brush statement. I mean, in my experience with the people that I've been dealing for, because they will automatically assess it as a commercial property because it's got plans and permits, and you're buying, they would expect that to sell. So, I mean, it's really stuffed the market up in that area. And, of course, developers, there's a lot of bad, karma goes out to developers from people kind of imagine that the developers are all out there land banking for capital gains. But the smaller developers that work in the inner city that do it for, they're not. Okay. And they're your friend because they're the ones that are densifying the suburbs. And obviously, all developers are greedy. Everybody wants to make a profit out of what they're doing, but it's really affected the market. So there are, a lot of blocks that you can out there that are available that you can split up. And obviously, it depends on the zoning. And then that leads into a whole different subject of zoning windfalls.
So we can probably leave that one as a negative for Sydney and Brisbane, but perhaps not for Melbourne.
Maybe. Yeah. I mean, yeah. I think that you might even see it in prices, yeah, in on those developments.
Just quickly, you mentioned before, so the delays with the council. So is that sort of a NIMBY drive, or is that so that's not in my backyard for those who don't know NIMBY, or is it just that, so is this council controlled supply that we're looking at
just
in infill?
Working with the councils has been unbelievable. You never know how long it's going to take you to get your plans and permits approved, and obviously if you get neighbours that are protesting against a development, all of that process has to work through itself anyway. But it's not so much that, it's that you have something in council and then you're dealing with someone who's just gone on maternity leave, or they've just gone on holiday, or it's at the bottom of the pile, or they'll get back to you. And so, you know, you can buy something, say, on a 12-month settlement and think that you'll get the plans and permits in 12 months for something, as I said, quite simple, say a 3-townhouse development. And after 12 months, you still haven't got those plans and permits. You haven't done anything to do with working drawings. You've got to then settle on the land, right? Which is going to be higher finance anyway, because whoever's going to value the land is going to see that you've made an application to get plans and permits. And the only way you can get bank finance for the build is once you have the working drawings and a building contract in your hand, and then you can go to the banks and say, okay, we want to do the build. So it really does, there's a lot of you know, it makes the whole process a lot more difficult than it should be, and I think that is a problem for supply.
Okay, just one last one as well, actually. So there's a scenario that I've seen in the past where people buy the land, get the permits, sell it with the permit, so the council effectively does all the work in, you know, approving it, and then it gets unsold, and then the next person says, okay, I can't do 10 apartments, I now need to do 20. Is that something that you've seen in your experience, where it's sort of like flipping with permits is almost an inner market in itself? But
that's great in the Fisherman's Bend scenario.
Okay, yeah.
it doesn't happen in the normal scenario because, you know, whenever you buy the land, if you're experienced at doing it, and I take on board that some people aren't, but you are assessing as much as you can what you can do on that land and get a profit. You know, it's not as easy in this market in particular to go and do get plans and permits and then expect to make some kind of profit on it. In a rising market, maybe.
Okay.
But, you know, it's a case-by-case thing. Whenever you buy a block of land, if it's got plans and permits, you've got to kind of look at those and say, well, could we fit another one on? And if we do, it's a higher cost for the build, and then we've got to work out what we're going to get as a return. So you don't see it. That kind of speculation, you'll get it in areas like Fisherman's Bend, where you get we all know that story. But not so much in
for anyone not Melbourne listening, it's a new infill development in close to the city in
Docklands.
The new boom,
more or less.
The new apartment boom.
So we better get to the big three.
Let's jump across now. So we're back to demand now. For those following at home, we're going to kick off with credit availability.
Yeah, so there's the three big ones: credit availability, price of credit, and employment. So the credit availability, huge sort of three up in 2012 to 2017. Basically, we settled on, I mean, every housing boom, in my view, has a new source of credit and a new way of getting more money out to people who probably can't afford what they're doing. But, and whether it be that you get a shadow banking system like you did in the US, or whether you get some interest rate in Ireland where you're getting interest rates run for Germany, but so that you've got really low interest rates in a growing economy and lax supervision, or Australia, we decided that our trick was going to be to use a poverty measure to assess everyone's income, which meant we could then lend a whole bunch more. And that really, you know, turbocharged credit for that period. 2018 came to a shuddering halt as the Royal Commission sort of settled on it. And then post-election, now we're in this, I don't know, to be honest. We've got this up and down. So on one side, we've got the government coming out and pushing out these new, basically saying, yeah, I want to get as much credit out. You know, I don't care if you can't borrow, if you can't afford to borrow that, I'm going to lend you 95% of you. You know, I'm going to help you borrow 95%. They've also got APRA has been pushed around and said, okay, well, you've got to assess everyone at 7%. And now APRA's come around and said, okay, no, that doesn't have to be the case anymore. It just needs to be a margin. And banks are big boys. They can, despite all the problems they had in the Royal Commission, I'm sure they won't do that same thing again.
They've learned, learned.
Yeah, that's right. We're two months on. You know, everything's fixed. And so on that front, and it does look, I mean, I've heard from a few people, and David in particular keeps saying, it's the thin end of the wedge. There's more coming. You know, if there's more problems, we have a housing we have a housing minister now. We've got a prime minister who's effectively a housing minister as well. You know, we're going to throw more at it. So credit's going to be available is sort of the I guess what you're hearing from the government. On the flip side, we still have the Royal Commission. We still haven't got, and as you said, you know, developers are still having problems getting finance. We still haven't solved the problem yet of saying, well, how can we possibly lend more to these people who can't afford it? You know, we want the ability. Maybe there are other tax cuts or, you know, tax deductibility or whatever it is. I'm sure there's a bunch of other tricks. But the credit availability part to me is, it seems as if the industry's gone, wow, we're done. You know, this was problem solved. We're, you know, off to the races again. Whereas I sort of feel as if we're stuck in this, I don't know where it's going. Could be up, could be down.
Like, it's clearly lower than it was 2012, 2017. Mm. I don't think there's any question about that, even after the recent rollback of constraints. You know, you've got the banks have all deployed their new, poverty measure, as it were. Not quite so poverty-stricken for everyone. They're assessing things much more stringently. APRA has made the move on making more credit available by reducing the buffer, but all of those other particulars are still there, and that will take time to erode, you know, as it will be eroded, of course, just the nature of the reform cycle. But that will take time. You still have the court cases going with ASIC versus Westpac on the poverty measure called the HEM. That's looking likely to actually fall the way of Westpac at the moment.
Also, Maurice Blackburn's doing a class action as well.
Then you got the private class actions.
So what do you think it's going to fall away with Westpac?
Well, Justice Perham did it once, and most of the commentary around the court case from him so far has been pretty Westpac oriented.
Right.
You know, like, he seems to be a guy that pretty much, you know, comes down on the side of people who need to take care of themselves rather than having consumer protections. Right. My guess is that Westpac will probably win that case. Mm. But then you get then there'll still be the class actions irrespective.
Because it's an interesting question in itself, isn't it? Saying, well, we know these people couldn't borrow.
But even so, right?
But so if I shove a new home buyer and shove a 95% mortgage on him,
everything's fine.
Yeah, that's all fine.
But well, yeah, but that's a policy question. I mean, that's not what we're here for. Like, you know, at the end of the day, like, that's the reform cycle. Like, the interests are going to push back and they're going to bash it all out of shape again. But the banks have already deployed all of their new lending standards, right, post-HEM. Mm. And that's going to take a time, I think, to wind back. So I think that's a real constraint ongoing, which only makes me think that APRA has to keep cutting on its interest rate buffer. And that probably brings us to the price of credit. I think that it puts more heat on the RBA as well. So the price of credit is about to get cheaper by at least 2 rate cuts, but I think it's more likely to be 4 with 2 more next year, simply because there won't be enough credit, I don't think.
Mm.
Certainly versus 2012, 2017. There might be enough just to get it rolling a bit, but not enough to really get any momentum in the market.
So I've called credit, just for those listening in, I've called credit a double positive for 2012 to 2017, where we had a bunch of rate cuts. 2018 was flat. I mean, possibly even up, probably even a negative, that we had some out-of-cycle rate rises, but largely there wasn't much change in the price of credit. So it was quite an interesting housing bust, in terms of usually it's the interest rates get jacked up and then people start to default, and that's what sort of drives the housing market down. Whereas we're completely out of sync on this. Yeah. We've just jumped straight to the
constraining house. On the price of credit, we also have to consider the banks aren't going to pass it all on, and the lower the cash rate goes, the less they're going to pass on, basically because they're at the zero bound and they can't smash their depositors anymore, so their net margins get smashed every time there's a rate cut.
Mm.
So out of the 100 basis points in cuts we've got coming, maybe mortgagees will get, to pick a number, 70, 60, would be my guess, 70 say, which, you know, is not material versus what happened, you know, in 2011, 12, 13 when we had a lot more easing. So credit availability is is probably, you know, a slight and increasing positive as they keep kicking the can, but it's certainly not enough yet, and they'll have to keep kicking it, would be my assessment.
Yeah, something to add, Catherine?
Obviously, a house is worth what the bank will lend, first of all. Secondly, you know, the Royal Commission, sure, we I agree with everything that's been said. I mean, mortgage fraud has existed since the temples were overturned in the the tables were overturned in the temple. The hardest thing I think about credit is because it affects the housing market so significantly. It reminds me of the work that we do at Prosper, which is that when we talk to government on both sides of the table, they all understand that, you know, an economy that runs on land taxation and doesn't tax income so high is an economy that's great. But when you've, you know, breastfed the nation on the notion that the way to get wealthy is through housing speculation, you've written that into policy. So you're actually saying to people that by the time you retire, we want you to own your own home, have, you know, made a significant amount of unearned income from it because it's gone up in price, and then sell it, and that's going to fund your retirement. When you've got something like that, it's the transition. You can't just suddenly hit the economy with a hammer, think that we're going to avoid a recession and that it's all going to be okay. The actual transitioning the economy is what we've had, if you like, with the Royal Commission. The Royal Commission has said, okay, we're not going to lend to you. We're going to make lending standards a lot harder. It's pretty much crashed the real estate market. Had that continued, real estate would have continued to go down and we would have sunk into a recession. Had Labour got in, it wasn't the negative gearing so much. You don't negatively gear unless you get capital gains. So the capital gains discount was a significant policy, taken away, that was a significant policy changer. So that's what we were expecting if Labour got in, was for Australia to potentially go into a recession and then to see what came out of that recession. But otherwise, unless you're going to do those changes to the economy and work out how you can transition the economy without pushing it into recession, which there's a lot of thought and effort that goes into that, then the banks have to start lending again. And I don't see that there's anyone that is going who understands the economics of what's going on, who is going to allow the country to go into recession on their watch. I certainly don't think the government are going to do it.
Yeah, but the question I've got, though, is do they have the power? Because if they wait too long, I mean, there's plenty of countries out there that Ireland, Spain, US, they didn't want their economies to go into recession. They wanted their housing markets to keep ticking along. They didn't want this to happen. But it's a question about saying if you wait too long and you don't throw enough at it, then it's too late. It doesn't matter.
You spoke a minute ago about the interest rates being jacked up. Mm. You study the housing cycle. That happens at the end of every 18 years. The economy is going gangbusters. There's a heap of speculation going on. Mm. Every time the RBA meet, they jack the interest rates up until the lending rates get too high. The productive sectors of the economy have been eroded away. No one can afford the debt. The private debt is sky high. Mm. And you can start to get a heap of foreclosures. That's what happens when the housing market crashes. The housing market crashes when people can't afford the debt and they have to sell. And the flood of stock that goes onto the market pushes the prices below the loan funds in the bank. And that's where you've got a significant financial crisis. And you can do two things. You can let it collapse and change your tax system. Or you can do what Kevin Rudd did and throw everything at it. If you look at the countries that have really succeeded in changing the system so that housing remains affordable and they don't have speculation in housing, it's countries with long-term governments. We have short-term governments that have 3 years in power and have to win the voters' attention. And unfortunately, everybody's thinking of their own back pocket in the large majority of cases. They're not thinking about how, they're not understanding the economy. They're not economists.
So we know, therefore, that they're just going to keep throwing stuff at it. Basically,
and the question is whether they can throw enough. Because let me. I wanted to jump. This is sort of starts to feed into this employment one. Yep. But I've got this 2012 to 2017 where every single one of those factors we've talked about is a positive. Like it was the perfect time. We just had everything we could throw at the housing market. We threw at the housing market. Employment was quite good through that time period. So that was sort of implied employment was coming down, except in WA. So Perth, we had exactly the same criteria. You could argue the population growth wasn't quite as strong, but it was still pretty good. Like it's still 2-3% per annum. But every single one of those factors was there, except for employment, where unemployment went the other way, and house prices fell away the whole time. So I guess what I'm coming back to is, if post election there's a problem with employment, then I'm positing that it doesn't really matter what the government, they can throw all this stuff at it. But we've already seen that we threw all this stuff 2012, 2017. It didn't help the Perth market go up. Perth market fell through the same way. So that, I guess I'm I'm presenting that as more of this pro-cyclical stuff in terms of saying we either get through this and everything's all right, or we don't get through it and we're headed a long way lower and there's not much in between.
I think using Perth as an example is a dangerous thing in a way, because Perth sits apart. There's a very unique things about the Perth economy, yep, which doesn't apply to the rest of Australia. And remember, in terms of the housing market in Perth, that was a lot of out-of-state investment that was going into that housing market and following the mining boom, yep, and then of course got caught short.
But you could argue that the same for the rest of Sydney, Melbourne. It's a lot of out-of-country investment that's coming in, chasing it, and it's the same, the same factor. Because I guess what I'm saying, all those factors, though, the only one that was different, so population growth was less, but not significantly less. The only real factor that was different out of all of those ones was employment.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think with the employment thing, the picture is mixed, right? So we know dwelling construction is going to tank in the next year or so, probably the next 2 years. Dwelling approvals, latest data came out today on Thursday. It's down 27% from peak. It's fallen away. That means that for the next 2 years, dwelling construction is going to fall. And construction is 9% of the economy, 9% of employment. Then obviously with house prices falling that way, is on retail, et cetera, blah, blah, blah. But if for some reason the government is successful in turning around house prices so they start rising again, even if only gently, that'll at least stop the negative wealth effect from happening. So that should help boost employment. I think the picture's mixed. We know construction's going to tank, but as for the impact on all consumption side of the economy, we just don't know yet.
Yeah, I think unemployment's going to rise.
Yeah, definitely.
And wages growth is going to stall and slow, so you're definitely going to have an ongoing income problem in the economy. It's not going to be easy to turn that around fiscally. Like, basically, the infrastructure spend has plateaued and there's nothing, there is a big pipeline of stuff, but once it plateaus, it's very hard to get it moving again in any kind of hurry. By that, I mean get it growing year on year. It's going to go flat to fall over the next couple of years, not a lot, but a little, as the NBN rolls off. So that brings you back to the consumer as the major driver. And so if you're going to prevent a material rise in employment, you've got to stabilise the consumer.
I agree with that, but also bear in mind that a housing downturn doesn't just affect the real estate and the finance industry. There's a whole load of related industries which it has affected over this year. So you're talking about solicitors, building inspectors, traders, white goods, all of those things that go into. So because you start to see speculation pour back into the housing market, you start to see those industries doing better as well.
Sure.
And obviously, like Leith said, having a counter effect on whatever you're seeing when you're looking backwards at the stats.
Look, I don't see a big employment accident, but I think, wages are going to be an ongoing problem, and maybe unemployment, gets to 5.5 or something.
It's going to rise.
5.5 and 6 over the next, half year. And so I think at least for the next 6 months, it's a negative. There's still a question over it for 2020.
Definitely.
As well.
I mean, I guess my point is if Labor had gotten in and we had a much steeper housing accident, the unemployment rate would rise a lot more than, I guess, what I'm thinking now. Because the house prices are likely to at least recover or stabilise or rebound.
Yeah. So
do you think there's a little bit of self-stabilisation there, though, with Labor, where by removing it for existing and just leaving it and leaving it open for new builds, that it would just naturally sort of start to feather out that side of it as investors go, well, I still want negative gearing, so this is the option that I've been sort of forced to take? Or do you reckon that would have had much of an impact?
Doesn't matter anymore.
Yeah, it doesn't. I guess so. Yeah, you're right.
To an extent.
But see you in 3 years.
But that's right. But I guess from my perspective, it is that major question, though, about saying, it's like we've just missed this accident. We're like, whew, oh, we're safe now, But they're like, well, just a minute, we still can't see what's coming around the next corner. It's not I think certainly things look a lot better than they did. But I guess what I'm saying, I don't think we're out of the. I think there's
can
still.
Don't
hit it hard enough now, and I don't think they are hitting it hard enough. As you said, developers still aren't getting. If developers got lending tomorrow, if they suddenly turned around and went, right, you can all lend with a government guarantee if you're developing a property. It would still take 6 months to get the whole thing moving again or longer, as you said. But so the longer we go towards saying, let's just wait a little bit longer, and let's just wait a little bit longer and throw a little bit more, is maybe that maybe you end up in a position you don't expect. And where I guess where I'm coming to is I have a very low conviction in which direction is going in either direction.
Me too.
And I think there's a lot of people who've come out and said, oh, it's all over, it's all solved. You know, property's the only way is up from here. And I'm like, well, I can certainly see that occurring. I can see the reasons for it. But I can't see what the conviction why people are so convinced that this is it. It's all fixed.
Yeah.
A few things. Because I think that what happens over the downturn is that it's not so much that people lost the appetite to go out and buy. They do when they see prices going backwards, but people weren't able to access finance, so that was a significant factor. And then, of course, you get this thing where we've got, you know, people are refinancing their own homes at low interest rates. The idea that interest rates are going to keep falling. People weren't able to over-leverage. People were buying in at a good price. So I think that there's a lot of energy that kind of builds up over that time. And remember, our market runs on speculation. That's why we have, you know, people aren't... There's three ways to value a house. One is through... what I said to my 3 million plus client when he said to me they've overpaid, and I said there's no way you can value it because it's not a development site. The other way is that you buy for the rental income. Well, that's where we look like we're in the biggest bubble of all time because you know, you've got over 30 years to actually make any money out of the property. And the third way is through what you can actually develop on the land. You know, but I mean, people primarily buy with this speculative idea that prices are going to keep upwards. There's no rationality to that. To that mindset, but that is the mindset that it prevails in the Australian real estate market.
Exactly. So if that prevails, we're good. But if we don't make it through this period, that's where I'm going. I think there's not a middle ground for this. We're either there or we make it, and the attitude prevails, or something cracks, or they don't quite put enough into it, and all of a sudden you find people just going, well, I'm just going to wait. The prices have fallen again. You know, everyone told me prices were going to rise after Morrison got in, and they've fallen 5%. You know what? I'm just going to sit out and wait for a little bit longer. Or unemployment's rising. I'll just wait till unemployment stops rising. And then, you know, there's...
I'm going to completely disagree with you. I think I'm going to say that they'll do enough, but not fast enough, but enough to just keep that speculative fever in the market and enough to just stabilise prices, maybe give them a little bit of a boost over the next year or two. I mean, my model for all these shakeouts is Sydney 2003, which does fit the pattern again, where you had a big run-up in prices through all sorts of pro-cyclical stuff. Then you had a pretty healthy correction, and you had a pretty serious accident in the mortgage belt of Sydney. And it put a lot of this entire sort of ring of... you know, outside the inner suburbs, into negative equity for a number of years, and it stalled the move-up ladder in the market where, you know, everybody buys further out where they can afford and then looks to move in over time as they garner equity. And it just really kicked the shit out of house price growth in Sydney, and the only thing that went up for years was rents.
But I think that's a Sydney phenomenon because Sydney is so much higher priced and also because it's very centralised and you don't have the landscape like you have in Melbourne where you can go, say, 17 kilometres from the city. You're still fairly close to the city and buy at a good price. Same in the other states. You've got that campus a little bit different. But so, I mean, I think Sydney stands on it. I think Sydney always kind of peaks early in that sense where it kind of reaches a peak of affordability. And then what you see in Sydney is it still generates a lot of overseas migration because obviously it gets the students, but then people start leaving Sydney, so it starts to lose on interstate migration. And that's where Melbourne then, I think, becomes the boom-bust capital. And also Melbourne is an auction market. I think I said this to you on the phone, where when people start to see only 20% of the market in Victoria's auction. But it's, you know, in those inner and middle ring suburbs, it's quite a large proportion of that market. And when people start to see properties sell on the street, that becomes a very big emotional incentive to get in.
Yeah, look, I think that's always there. I just think there's lingering constraints that will prevent them getting as crazy as they would like to. It stops prices running away. You've got enough unemployment for forced sales, like not heaps of them, but enough. And so you're going to have to chew through more correction, in effect, before you can get any kind of new boom.
Yeah. But I'm assuming your view as well is subject to no external shocks.
Absolutely.
Mm. Yeah. External shock would throw it.
I think that would throw a complete spanner in the works. And actually, I don't think we've got very many years of rising prices before China slows enough that we face a major income shock anyway, which will then trouble housing again.
And on that bombshell, we'll have to finish up. Thanks, David, and thanks very much to the panel. A special thank you to Catherine for coming in. Do you want to just quickly let our audience know how they can follow some of your work?
Yep, my work website is cashmoreco.com.au, or you can find me around the Prosper team, which is prosper.org.au.
Excellent. Put you on the spot there. Very good. So, yeah, thanks again for coming along, and a lot of thanks to anyone who's popped in some questions, some thoughts here as well. There's some almost philosophical debates going on in our chat room there that we haven't quite got time today to cover off on, but yeah, thank you to that. And for those that are listening over the podcast and would like to comment or chat live, make sure you tune into next week's one. So we've got we've called it working title, the Aussie Dollar Dazzlers. That may change over the course of the next 7 days. However, it will have an Australian dollar theme, and we'll be featuring, of course, all the brains trust from Nucleus Wealth and the MB Fund. So on that note, thanks for your attendance today, and we'll catch you at the next one. Cheers. Well, that's it for now, and thanks for watching. If you like what you heard today and you'd like to hear more, head over to nucleuswealth.com/subscribe. Give us your email address, and in return, we'll send you a weekly email with new webinar topics, links for our podcasts, and other news from Nucleus Wealth. I certainly hope you've got something out of today, as I have, and we'll look forward to catching you at the next one. Cheers.